My father had a major stroke at the age of 79 that really obliterated the quality of his life. He couldn't really finish a sentence or fasten a belt. And unfortunately, 2 years after that devastating stroke, he was given a pacemaker. So he lived into a time of dementia and near blindness and misery and not even being able to make a phone call, when really a natural death would have been a blessing to him.
So take me through this. He had a stroke. The surgeon or the cardiologist comes to you and says, well, we recommend that your father have a pacemaker. I mean, that will extend his life.
Well, essentially, I want to tell you first three very important things my father said after he had that stroke, after he entered what I'm now calling the gray zone between living and dying. He said, I don't know who I am anymore. He said, I'm not going to get better. And finally, he said, I'm living too long. Now, what happened was that he developed a hernia. And in order to get a cardiac clearance for the hernia surgery, the cardiologist told my mother and father that he would first need to get a pacemaker because he had a slow heartbeat.
So they weren't going to allow the hernia surgery until he had a pacemaker?
In essence, yes. So the slow heartbeat had actually never given him any health problems, but it was sort of a just-in-case thing because of the stress of the surgery. Now, later, of course, we discovered that if we had really unpacked this decision and slowed it down, the surgery could have been done in another way that was less stressful, or we could have used a temporary pacemaker for the period of the surgery and then turned it off afterwards with no ill effect. But we didn't know that. We saw it as a no-brainer.
Well, sure, of course. The professionals who you defer to in situations like this, they say, your dad should get a pacemaker. I mean, why wouldn't you say yes?
But we were very concerned about other things, such as keeping him out of a nursing home, keeping him free of suffering, making him as functional and happy as he could possibly be. But extending this miserable period of his life was not on our agenda. But we didn't know how to talk about that.
Yeah. So what happened then? Did he end up in a nursing home?
No. My mother took care of him till the very end of his life. It was 6.5 years after his first stroke. He finally died on a hospice unit, and we quite intentionally did not ask that he be given antibiotics. He had pneumonia, which used to be called the old man's friend. And we finally, mercifully, allowed him to die a natural death.
So this must have been very hard on your mother, who had to devote her life, those years, to taking care of her husband.
I think it was terribly hard on her on two different levels. One was that she was simply experiencing ambiguous loss. She had lost the man who was her best friend, and now she was a nurse rather than a wife, or rather even than a widow. And she was also absolutely exhausted by the daily pressures of taking care of someone with dementia and stroke damage.
Did your father have an advance directive, a living will?
We had done everything right. They had advance directives, they had living wills, they had declared each other as medical power of attorney. But because the problems of the end of life are not problems that show up 3 days before someone is a candidate for an intensive care unit, these problems start showing up 5 years before that moment. And we're not prepared for that as a society. And in the gray zone, all of these medical decisions are values-based decisions, and they differ from person to person and family to family.
But what's confusing then is you said that you did everything right early on. I mean, you signed all the necessary documents. Your father had said, he had been very explicit about saying that he didn't want this kind of prolonged end-of-life care, and yet you went ahead anyway. I mean, I guess I'm trying to figure out why it played out that way.
Well, because I think if you look at most living wills, they talk about not being plugged into machines when you are either comatose or within 6 months of dying. That's a very narrow window. And my father's window was way, way longer than that. So after that stroke, when a doctor said to my mother, well, he has to get a pacemaker or he can't get this surgery. She essentially just shrugged her shoulders and said, oh, well, I know the family doctor doesn't think it's a good idea. I know Jeff didn't think it was a good idea, but now we're in a bind and we have no choice and we have to go ahead. She didn't really know at that point that she needed to ask questions and say, let's consult some other people. Let's spend even a couple days thinking about this, not just one of these standard issue 15-minute office appointments.
Do you think money influenced some of these decisions? I mean, what you could get reimbursed for?
Both directly and indirectly, money did influence these decisions. The pacemaker itself costs $7,500. It's a highly profitable medical device. And there are armies of salesmen and women who go out around the country and talk to cardiologists about the latest upgrades.
And health insurance, I mean, Medicare reimburses this surgery?
Exactly. Medicare reimburses pretty much totally, and it's a bit of a blank check situation. On the other hand, the family doctor, who was extremely opposed to putting in the pacemaker for exactly the reasons that played out, he would have been paid only $64 to have had an extended conversation with my parents about whether or not this was a good idea. So Medicare reimburses, and all insurance, reimburses extremely well for deploying technologies and extremely badly for spending time with patients. And these are deep, involved, and subtle conversations that need to take place.
This is a serious charge you're making. I mean, you're essentially saying that our health insurance reimbursement system, particularly through Medicare, drives a lot of end-of-life care.
Medicare reimbursement drives a great deal of misapplication of end-of-life care. So people might get a $323,000 death in an ICU over the course of 10 days, but Medicare won't pay anything close to that for a home health aide for a disabled and slowly dying person.
So Medicare pays for essentially what are considered curative procedures, but it doesn't really pay for just care.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So as a result, we have some insane situations. A doctor who administers a chemotherapy that may cost $5,000 or $10,000 a month will be paid a 6% markup on the price of that chemo. But if he wants to do the right thing and have an extended conversation with somebody about the fact that the third or fourth line of chemo is very unlikely to help, he'll essentially be barely paid at all. We are telling doctors what we value by what we pay for. And it's just really an unfair bind to be putting doctors in. And many of them agree that we have to get away from this fee-for-service medicine and start rewarding them better for their time and less for all these tests and technologies. Yeah, it's a problem throughout medicine, but it really shows up at the end of life. It's so poignant and painful at the end of life.